Acts chapter 14. The first seven verses of the chapter. It came to pass in Iconium that they went both together into the synagogue of the Jews, and so spake, that a great multitude, both of the Jews and also of the Greeks, believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles, and made their minds evil affected against the brethren. Long time therefore abode they, speaking boldly in the Lord, which gave testimony unto the word of his grace, and granted signs and wonders to be done by their hands. But the multitude of the city was divided, and part held with the Jews, and part with the apostles. When there was an assault made both of the Gentiles and also of the Jews with their rulers, to use them despitefully and to stone them, they were aware of it, and fled unto Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and unto the region that lieth round about. And there they preached the gospel. There is a time for God's servants to flee in the face of persecution. A time when they should abandon an area in which they have been seeking to serve the Lord and raise a testimony for Him. Abandon it at least for a time. There is another time when God's servants should refuse to flee. When they should respond to persecution in the very opposite way, by retrenching and by all the more determinedly standing for God and all the more openly doing the work of God. Now, Paul and Barnabas knew when to do both. There were times when they fled. There were other times when they refused to flee. I was particularly taken with the statement in verses 2 and 3 that the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and made their minds evil affected against the brethren. Made their minds evil affected means literally that they poisoned their minds or they embittered their minds. They stirred up their minds with the intention that the Gentiles would treat the apostles in an evil way. Long time, therefore, abode they, speaking boldly in the Lord. So on that occasion, the more bitter the opposition, the more determined was their stand. They refused to budge an inch. Now, when to do each of these two things is, of course, the question. Paul and Barnabas knew when to stand, and they knew when to run. It was not a matter of stubbornness and bravado on the one hand, or cowardice and timidity on the other hand. What determined whether they should stay or go was not even primarily their own safety, because obviously their safety was in very grave danger when they decided to stick it out. It was also in danger on another occasion, a little later, when they decided to move on. What determined their decision was a knowledge of the will of God and a single eye to the glory of God. And I would say that those are two things that every preacher needs to know and needs to have. Those are two things that every Christian would do well to ensure that he knows and has. A knowledge of God's will for his life, for his service. That what he's doing and where he is doing it are ordered of God. A knowledge of God's will. And secondly, a single eye to the glory of God. Where Christians have a clear sight of the Lord's glory, they will not be overwhelmed by the fear of man, they will be given grace in every situation that may face them. Paul and Barnabas had these two things, and I believe they controlled their thinking, they controlled their actions and their reactions to the situations that faced them in the work of the Lord. I thought of those things this morning as I was reading this portion of Scripture, and as I considered the work of God that Joan and I have just had the opportunity of visiting in the land of Kenya. I said this morning that I would make very little comment in the morning service on what we did or where we went, because I knew I'd be asked again this evening, and I thought we would do it all at one time and satisfy all. But as I thought of what we saw and what we did, and the people with whom we did it, my mind went to them through this portion of Scripture. Now, I must be honest, and here Joash Kendegor can put plugs in his ears because I know he'll not like this. But I must be honest that I was not really this year looking forward to going to Kenya. People kept asking me, are you looking forward to going to Kenya? Well, now, to be honest, if I had had time to plan a vacation and the money of Tom Piper here to pay for that vacation, no doubt I would have enjoyed looking forward to going to Kenya. I have promised Joash's dad, Nathaniel, at least 10 years ago, that I would go. Someday, I would go and help him in the work there. Never seemed an appropriate time. Last year, I was to go. But I couldn't honestly see my way clear to going. And so, I backed out one more time. Well, as you all know, our brother Nathaniel came to visit us here in Greenville. He stayed in our house. And the only way to get him back out of it was to promise I would go and visit him in his house. No, that's not quite true. We'd been happy to keep him. But actually, he did then bring the need. And so I had to make the solemn promise that 1997, by the grace of God, I will go. But there were many things piling in. And it's not that I didn't have any desire to go to Kenya, didn't desire to see the work and help in the work. But there were just too many things, and too many times to be away. As you know, I was preaching in Northern Ireland at the end of last year, the beginning of this year. I had two or three other requests for missions that I've had to let go. I've had to turn down going to various other churches, even here in the North American continent. And I was to be back in Northern Ireland for a big conference in Gordon Cook's church. Dr. Gingery will be delighted at the mention of Gordon Cook. He and Gordon go back a long time. To make you feel young, Gordon Cook retires this year. So this was one of his young friends. But anyway, I was to be there for that conference and then to move on to England to a United conference to do the what we call over there the Bible readings every morning. And as all these things were piling in, I honestly was hoping that something would happen that the Kenya people would call this off. But they didn't do so. And so I had to do some quick adjustments. And I called Gordon Cook and said, Gordon, get another preacher. I can't be there this summer. Talk to Brian Green, get another preacher. I can't be there this summer because I must fulfill this Kenyan trip. And I have to say, the Lord does all things well. The chairman of our missionary council, George McConnell, an elder from our Kilkeel church, some of you met him when he was here, has done a great, great work in helping the churches and the missionaries in Kenya and in just about every other place where we have workers. He told me, when you go to Kenya, the only thing you'll ever want to do is go back. And he thought I was rather skeptical. He said, I'll talk to you when you come home. And I have to say that he was right. You could speak of many things. There are various things, and if I ever get to show all or parts of the video that I took there, you'll get at least some idea of what I'm talking about. There are certain things that come as a surprise. For many years in Northern Ireland, ministered in a rural area. Our people were farmers. You hear them talk about the land. You talk about what's happening. And so when you drive through, you'd look at the land and the parts of Northern Ireland where they rejoice that they have what they think is the best land, the best, most fertile land. I'd always thought of Kenya as a place that would not have that kind of blessing. But in Western Kenya, I saw miles and miles and miles of the most fertile earth I have ever seen. And we were there, of course, at a perfect time to see it, because it was the wet season, the long rains, and everybody and his brother was out planting maize. And it was interesting to see them in Kikuyu country with the oxen out ploughing there. And the man actually in this occasion was doing the harder work. That's most unusual, especially among the Kikuyus. When you see the women with these great bundles on their head, they'd be carrying firewood that would stretch from here to the piano, and they'd have it on their head. Women walking along with 5-gallon drums of water on their head and carrying a bag in their hand, and maybe a baby on their back. The women certainly there, their posture is very good, I'll tell you. But on this occasion, the man was struggling with the oxen, and the woman was coming right behind him, about 5 yards behind him, sowing right into the ground after he had ploughed it. The area was certainly tremendously fertile and looking very green. The scenery was tremendous. West Pequot, the area that we were in, certainly enjoys beautiful, beautiful scenery. There are three mountains. You have Mount Elgon, and then you have Mount Kenya, and then you go down just over the border into Tanzania, and you have Mount Kilimanjaro, and they get slightly bigger, a couple of thousand feet each time. Mount Elgon, I was informed by my guide one day, is the largest single-core extinct volcano in the world. So I scratched my head and said, does that mean that there are single-core volcanoes in the world that are not extinct, they're still active, and they may be bigger? She said, I haven't a clue. Why do you ask questions like that? I said, well, if you give information, I have to ask. But all around that area, the scenery certainly is beautiful, and you could enjoy a vacation, especially at that time of year, at 7,000 feet altitude in the winter season. Temperatures are not going to be much more than 70, 73 degrees, so no humidity really, despite the rains. It was really very easy to enjoy the scenery. And, of course, everybody thinks, when they think of Kenya, they think of safari. Well, yes, we even had a little of that. I'd like to have had a whole lot more of it, but we did have that. Joan saw a leopard. Very, very few people ever see leopard. They're nocturnal. They're very, very hard to get a glimpse of. But she did. I didn't. I went to the wrong lookout post. Trust a woman. I had the camera. She didn't. But, however, she saw it anyway. Many, many other things. It's a beautiful sight driving through, and you come on, maybe 12, 15 giraffes and they're young and they're most graceful, and just see them in their natural habitat just moving around. Now, Joan wasn't quite so happy when we were driving up close to the rhinoceros. We got about maybe 40 yards away. We're driving over the field. We're trying to get closer. Remember what I said this morning? Everything there is so rough, the roads, the tracks. Trying to get a video is nearly impossible because it's like on a ship in a gale, you know, you're up and down like this. But we were going over the field to get close to them, and Margaret Russell, who was feeling rather sick that day, she said, I think I can get even closer. Get round the back there. Get up real close. Well, I thought my better half was going to have a heart attack in the back seat. And she said, "No, no, no, those rhinos will come, and you see those huge horns," she called them. "Do you see those? They'll just come and they'll topple this car. What chance would we have?" Well, I thought a picture of a rhino is good, but having to pay the expense of a funeral in Kenya and get a body back out of it, it's just too much. So we decided we wouldn't do that. You could talk about the safari. Certainly, there are wonderful things to see. But most of all, and I don't say this just because we're in church, the best part to remember and talk about are God's servants and God's saints. As I say, we spent our time in West Pequot. It's a beautiful area, but for all that, it's a troubled area. The area reaches up to the Ugandan border. Those beautiful valleys, you look at a mountain range, this is in Kenya, that is in Uganda. There are tribes that straddle the border. Cattle rustling is big. And you've got entire areas that are denuded of population just through fear. And actually, we were finding out from the Daily Press that this was quite a headache for the government, not only there, but in other parts, about having to accept this and simply relocate entire peoples. And it was causing a great deal of concern. Well, we were just brought to realize some of the troubles. And it's in that area that our brother Nathaniel Kemdegor leads a work of 7 churches, soon to be 8. I think actually I have a little information that even Joash doesn't have. But we met a man in one of the Bible studies, a representative from another area. And in his area there was a new church soon to start. So soon to be 8 churches there. We visited some of the churches. We were in the church where our brother Nathaniel ministers, a place called Liche. We were in 3 other churches, and we took over a school for a couple of days to speak to the young people. That was one of the main reasons for being out there. Speak to the Bible college students, just a couple of them, and to spend 2 full days with young people from high school, who, most of them at least from high school, some have finished high school and are in college, who are under the most awful pressure from 2 areas, from Roman Catholicism on the one hand, and from the charismatic movement on the other hand. So I was there to deal with some of the issues, especially dealing with the biblical doctrine of the person and work of the Holy Spirit, and very particularly from 1 Corinthians chapter 14, on what the Bible teaches on the phenomenon in the New Testament of speaking with tongues. And that certainly had to be, for Nathaniel, in many ways the most important part, because that he hoped was going to give his young people the training, the teaching, and the grasp of the Scriptures that would enable them to stand up under the battery that they were getting from all these other places. Now, it was a very busy time. We spoke to the men. We spoke to the women. We spoke to the young people. There were special times on an introduction to homiletics. I thought that was funny, that they'd be coming to me to introduce them to homiletics. If you went to Bert Cook, our homiletics professor in Northern Ireland, he would really die laughing to think that I was set up as any sort of an authority in homiletics. But anyway, that was done. Some theology and the doctrine of redemption. And then these meetings with the young people. And then finally, the church services where we got to speak to the people generally and take part in the annual prize distribution for one of the Sunday schools. Because there's a very active Sunday school and young people's work in connection with each of these churches. Now, that was our schedule. It was busy, and certainly the Lord blessed. We had a wonderful time, and I believe we had a sense of God's presence. The Sabbath morning, we went to see this church And it was way out in the, the sticks, but it was way out in the ways. It seemed a long way off. It's a place called Embogat. And there they have an elder in charge of the work. And as we got there, we found that the children had been there from 8 o'clock in the morning. The service started at 11 o'clock. Now, I must say, Kenya is my kind of place. I think I could live quite happily there. Would drive D.L. Iverson to distraction. You see, you announce a meeting for 9 o'clock in the morning, and about 11 o'clock you turn up there thinking, well, they'd probably be thinking of coming by now. Time means nothing. Nothing at all. And there's no such thing as you're 5 minutes late. It doesn't exist. Now, it may in Nairobi, but certainly not up around Kapenguria. So, these children have been there from 8 o'clock in the morning. The morning service started. It was supposed to start about 11. It was about 11:30, near 12 o'clock maybe. It got started. We had the normal service. Then they had the prize distribution. And those children were still sitting there, as good as gold, quiet, attentive. They weren't on pews. You can go around this church and find that we have, over the years, now I'm not saying we still have them. I would not dare on Mother's Day particularly to enter that particular lioness's den. But if you go around these pews, you'll find that we have had some tremendously active little children, beautiful little babies, who actually take bites out of the wood in the pew. You can actually see the teeth marks, where they're so engrossed, they're biting the pew. We're actually thinking of putting up a few big placards. Please feed them before they come to church. Give them their fiber from all brand, but not from the church pews. Anyway, these children were sitting on a mat on a mud floor. 8 o'clock in the morning. By the time they were getting their chai, which is a peculiar corruption of tea known only to the Kenyans. And as Joash likes it, drinkable only by Kenyans. But by the time they got that, and two slices of dry bread, it was 2 o'clock. I think we could maybe learn something there. But the Lord blessed there. I preached the gospel that morning. I believe that the Lord gave the message as I studied in Margaret's house. And many people responded as the elder made the public appeal. And certainly three young adults were dealt with at length after the meeting. One young man, a Roman Catholic farmer, came to know Christ as a Savior. Another young man whose family was in the church, he himself was not saved that day, came to know Christ. Another young woman, of maybe in her 20s, came to know the Savior that day. And the people were greatly encouraged that the Lord was blessing and that His presence was felt. And certainly the level of attention to the Word of God was very, very encouraging, even when it had to be done through an interpreter. Now, that's the area in which Nathaniel's working, with Margaret Russell, Gillian Gillespie, two of the young ladies that have gone out from Northern Ireland, soon to be joined by one of our ministers, the Reverend Ian Harris, and his wife. His wife is Margaret's sister, though that has no bearing on their going to Kenya, but soon to be joined by them. That will be our mission team in Kenya, along with a young woman who was a very worldly young woman. She was born in Kenya, though she was of European extraction, English extraction, but she's born in Kenya, brought up in Kenya. Though her family have now moved to Australia, she is still in Kenya. She was very worldly, played golf every day of the week, wakened up every morning with a hangover from the night before, just was living what she thought was the high life. came into contact with Margaret, and the Lord began to deal with her heart. And after the murders that rocked the church there, and I'll speak of those in a moment, Cherry was spoken to, and the Lord saved her. And now she's helping in the work. She is looking after the bookstore, a wonderful bookstore they have in a town called Kitale. A tremendous range of books, and they're doing a good work there. And she's in that work. So that really is the mission team. They have various other pastors, and they have various other elders working with Nathaniel and under his leadership. Now, Nathaniel and his people have seen a great work done for God. And they have a great work still to do. When I think, and I wish that for the moment Joash weren't here, because it would be easier for me to say this. But when I think of Nathaniel Kendigore, I consider him to be the very best African pastor I have ever met. I don't know any other man from that country or many other men from any country that I would place on the spiritual plane of this man. He's a man that I personally regard in the highest way. And I count it a privilege to know him. I count it a privilege to work with him. And I don't mean this as any sort of bogus modesty. In many ways, I wonder why he would be looking for help from me. When I look at him and his people, as I say, I thought of them when I read this passage of Scripture this morning. I hadn't intended to take this line at all today. But as I read this in my own study this morning, this is how the Lord burdened my heart. And I'm not really preaching to you tonight. I'm just going to talk to you about the work of God there and the people of God there. I thought of them because I saw in Nathaniel and his people what I believe first is a profile, or maybe many profiles, in Christian character. You see Christianity and Christian character in very clear terms. It's very, very simple for us to imagine that life everywhere is the way it is here. We went to the ladies' meeting. Now, it's not like our ladies' meeting here. Margaret pointed out to me just before I spoke. She said, there are two wives of a local polygamist. And they're in the service. Pointed out an old lady up the front. You could see where they used to pierce the ears, and beauty was to pull them down and have these long waits. She had such holes in her earlobes that the earlobes were almost reaching the shoulders. She had what a Northern Irish cartoonist once said of a local politician's face. She had that lived-in look. And certainly, there was great darkness there. She wasn't saved. You'd see children coming with the beads to ward off the spirits. There's still that to be dealt with. This is the background. And against that background, as we were in that meeting, we saw women who just exuded the glory of the Lord. There's one young woman we came to know a little and to love a lot. She's in her mid-30s. She is married with, what, 4 children? And her husband is just up and gone. The day starts before the dawn for this girl. She'll be out working in the land. She'll be out cleaning. She'll be out doing other jobs to provide for her children. Life for her is hard. I watched her in that woman's meeting. We couldn't carry on with the meeting for the best part of an hour because it was a tropical downpour. If you can imagine the kind of downpours we can get here in Greenville, that's what they were having on a tin roof. So there's no use trying to talk. You couldn't be heard. The women, of course, could talk. Same the world over, black or white, rich or poor, they can always talk. So they talked together. And then they just started to sing. Now, you've never heard singing till you've heard Africans sing. They murder the tunes. They make them into tunes of their own. But they sound tuneful. And they have a natural sense of harmony. Without knowing a note of music, you'll find the men will be singing parts. And it sounded very good. They didn't have men there in the ladies' meeting, but just saying there's this natural sense of harmony. They started to sing. And I looked down at Catherine. Her face was aglow. She was in those songs. She had just walked about 6 or 7 miles over the roughest roads you can think of, cross country, to be there. That takes a bit of Christian character. And then to be singing with the joy and the glory and the beauty of the Lord in her face. I want to tell you, that moved my heart immensely. And it challenged me. When I think of how we gripe and we groan, and we can hardly walk more than the length of 2 cars, if the parking lot is full, we have to walk the whole parking lot to get to church. My, it's so difficult. These people were coming in, many of these ladies, caught in that tropical downpour. They're coming in soaked to the skin. Still rejoicing just to be able to be there. We did see profiles in Christian character. We saw profiles in Christian courage. Now here we come to what we were talking about. There are times when God's people should run and there are times when they should stay. Nathaniel, at a time, had thought to move. But God has done a thing to make him stick in a place where it really hurts. One of the most moving times I had in Kenya was when we were going up to one of the men's meetings. Margaret was taking me up to the men's meeting. She pointed out the home in which Nathaniel had lived with his family. Joash was there. And I hope it'll not be too painful for him, for me to relive this. When paid gunmen came in, seeking for the life of Nathaniel, not finding him, they murdered his nephew and his sister. My video will not be very good, for the lighting was all wrong and we didn't have professional equipment and lights, etc. But Margaret relived those minutes, the hours indeed, for me. Took me through that now empty house. Explained how this had all developed. Went into the little kitchen where some of the young people in the family had been sitting, terrorized. And she went in and she found Ruth sitting, dead. It was very difficult for Margaret to relive that. These people have been found guilty, the criminals, of another crime on which they pay the death penalty. But throughout the period of waiting while there's a mandatory appeal, Nathaniel, who has moved house but is still in, he's living in the town now, but the church is still in the area, he's still in the area, he has received multiplied threats on his life, and yet he takes a stand. Those two young people are buried just across from the church, right under the noses of the people who planned their murder. And you can see what that means to those people. Nathaniel told me, had the murders not taken place, it is quite possible that the entire church location would have been moved. But now, we are here to stay. And it will be on that site that their Bible college will be erected. It will be on that site that their young people will be trained. And from that place of death, will start going out the word of life. I want to tell you, when you look at those two graves, when you drive along the road, as I did with Margaret when we were going to yet another meeting, and you're flagged down by a man who's asking for a ride for a young mother who is carrying a lot of stuff, a great weight. I wondered, why is Margaret so offhand, so dry, so unfriendly, really, to this man? She told me, you know, I find it very, very difficult to this day to speak to that man. For we believe with good evidence that he and his family helped to plan these murders. This is something these folk live with day by day. They don't make a big deal of it, but it takes courage. And I have to be honest that I come from a country where some of our ministers, Dr. Paisley notably, Reverend Ivan Foster, Reverend William McCrae, where they have lived on the edge of danger. So I know what it is for men to live in the shadow of a gunman, of a murderous thug or group of thugs. When I looked at Nathaniel, I saw courage. That courage showed itself at other times when the church was not registered and the government made it illegal for them to meet as a church. They spent some little time in jail even. But again, he would not bend or bow or break. I hope now you understand why I say, I wonder why that man would look for help from me. I stand in many ways in awe of a man of God like that. Of course, the courage isn't always of that nature, just. There's other kind of courage. When I look at our missionaries there, I have to be honest and say, those young women, they have more courage than any half a dozen soldiers. I mean, here are single girls. Each of them lives, well, Margaret lives about 20, 25 miles away from where the others live, but each of them lives in their own house. It's a compound. It's all wired off, and big gates and locked gates, and I'll not say guard dogs, although they're supposed to be that. They may be more there to bark than anything else. But there is always a danger there. To be a single woman in an alien culture, and so isolated and so vulnerable, and you're there for one reason only. You know, the romance falls away very quickly. When you go visiting a country, you have romantic views of that country. But when you live in that country from week to week and year to year, you see it as it really is. And believe me, Kenyans are just like everybody else. And there are some ugly, bad ones, and there are some decent ones. People are like that the world over. And it takes courage. There are profiles of courage there. and profiles of commitment. Let me tell you something, and I would wish that this would turn out to be true of our church here. Let me tell you something that really is astonishing, that our brother Nathaniel told me. During the whole struggle with the government, when those churches were forbidden to operate as churches, and they were under pressure to compromise and go in with other groups so that they could operate under their license, their registration, he wouldn't do that. He would not do it. No matter what the cost was, he wouldn't do it. They were called to take a stand, and it didn't matter whether the government liked it or didn't like it, they were going to take a stand on this Bible. They call themselves the Bible Christian Faith Church, BCFC, and that's their whole reason to exist, to preach the Christian faith. They're not in political movements. Their churches span different tribes and different peoples. So they're not in political movements, but they were apparently a danger to the government, and they were not permitted to exist. People told them, you're going to lose all your work. You can't hold on to your people. But they met in homes, and they kept meeting, and they said, now we have got our registration, finally. And he said, not one of our people, not one of them, left us. Can you imagine that? I mean, in Greenville, people would leave a church and change a church if the minister had a wrong color of suit or tie on. But there, under such intense pressure, when there was every attraction and every inducement to change, as far as Nathaniel's concerned, there would be money. There would be overseas help. There would be this, there would be that, there'd be many things. If you'll only change. But no, we won't change. Because what we're doing is God's will. That's why we're doing it. And not one of those people turned tail and ran. Not one of those people forsook the church to which God had called them. Not one. Not one. When he told me that, I could hardly believe it. I asked him again. Of course, to be quite honest, it sounds too good to be true. But again, he repeated it. We didn't lose anybody. I believe that is great commitment. And the Lord is blessing that Christian character and courage and commitment. God is blessing it. And they are seeing a work done for the Lord. They're seeing people saved. Many of their people saved are saved right out of Roman Catholicism. When you go through, and I'm sure this may be true in other parts of Kenya and Africa, but certainly when you go through Western Kenya, they can point out this area was missioned by the Presbyterians. This area was missioned by the Episcopalians. This area was missioned by Lutherans. This area was missioned by Roman Catholics. And the Roman Catholic Church has certainly made tremendous strides. And you will find that there are many, many people who are nominally Roman Catholic. And many of the people that they have seen saved in the BCFC churches have come out of that background. One young man who translated for me, a very brilliant young man, he has been saved about 3 years. He's saved out of a Roman Catholic background. I mentioned one of the young men who trusted Christ the morning I was in Mbogat. Was a young man, and it looked to me about his mid-20s. And he was a Roman Catholic, and that day came to know Christ. So God is certainly blessing them, and they're seeing people saved. Now, they face great challenges, tremendous challenges. And I tell you this, that you may pray for them. And perhaps, I would certainly trust that in our churches in North America, we will be able to do more than pray for them and be able to help them in the days to come. But there are many challenges. When you go to Kenya or any emerging country, You can see the kind of scenes that television documentaries love to portray to stir up people to give. When you go to Nairobi, you can see street children. Nairobi is a city of many people. In fact, the abiding memory you have when you visit Kenya for the first time is people. Everywhere there are people just streaming along every road, walking, carrying loads on their head. Well, the women carrying loads on their head, the men sometimes riding a bicycle beside them. Man, wouldn't it be good to live in Kenya? But anyway, you can see in a city like Nairobi, you know, tremendously modern, beautiful buildings. We noticed it's the same there as it is in America. The banks are always prosperous. Beautiful, majestic bank buildings. But right side by side with that, great poverty. About 20% of the population are making huge amounts of money and the other 80% are in subsistence. It's a real good formula for trouble. You see the street children. And they'll come up every time you stop at the traffic lights. And they'll come up and they have their patter off. They put out their hand. You daren't put your window down because the hand would be in as quick as a monkey's and whatever was in reach would be gone. But they have their hand out. God says that we should share. Will you not give to me? God will bless you. That's one of the lines. If you ask them, as Margaret did, why are you not at school? They just put their head down and take off. Most of them are either the young ladies, the young girls, or prostitutes, or on drugs, sniffing glue, the fumes of petrol, gas, and other drugs. You can look at that and say, there's a great need there. And there is a great need there. I mean, anybody's heart not moved by a sight like that would be a hard heart indeed. Yes, there is a great need there. But it's almost a bottomless pit. And I really don't think it's the place to start. Let me tell you of another need. And I think this is a place to start. This is something that Nathaniel brought to my attention. In the school system in Kenya, every child must go to school. Every family must pay for the children to go to school. That puts a tremendous strain on the little family farm. If you knew what that one stretch of ground had to turn out every year, you'd be amazed. Somehow they managed to do it. So they pay for them to go to school. But for about 9 years, those children will be in boarding schools away from home. 9 months out of every year. 3 months gone, 1 month back home. 3 months gone, 1 month back home. Now you can immediately see in a school system that is more and more being taken over by the Roman Catholic Church and being used illegally by that church. For it is illegal for them to demand that students would go to Mass, but they forced them to do so nonetheless. One of Nathaniel's daughters was forced to do this in her boarding school. The priest was not very happy when, instead of converting, she tried to convert him and began to ask him questions about the Mass and from the Bible. And they said, we don't want any of those questions. The headmistress of the school was so angry with her. I don't think. She was so happy, I think, that somebody had stood up to this little priest that she gave the young girl promotion, what we would have called in Britain a prefect. I don't know what they call them there. But give her some promotion. But it takes guts to do that for a young person. Can you imagine the difficulty of a church in teaching its young people and then seeing them for three quarters of every year for the nine most important years of their lives to be in the hands of Roman Catholic priests and nuns? Or to be in the hands of raving, mad charismatics who get them all together turned upside down. So what they were saying was, starting in January, they're going to be hopefully starting their own school. First school. They're going to need many schools, but first they're going to start, and they hope to start with primary levels, but they'll soon, very, very soon, have to move into a school that is a boarding school. Now that is a tremendous challenge. It costs money, and of course, the people don't have money. They're already paying, and they do support themselves, and they do pay. It would have brought tears to a stone when we were in that children's or the Sunday school meeting, when they came round with the offering basket. And they did take up the offering, and all those little children, many of them very poorly dressed. One young fella, you know, you could have smiled and you could have cried at the same time. One wee fella about 8 years old thought he was so beautifully dressed. He'd got something from the West. And there he was at Sunday school in a pair of pajamas. He saw these little children giving their money. And as the offering had been received, I noticed from the back of the crowd a girl of about 8 or 10 years old with a little one in her arms struggling through. They had missed her in the offering. And there she came with not much on her back, not a shoe on her foot. And I thought of the widow's mite. They give. The one thing I liked about these churches, and this is most, and I don't want to sound insulting to Africans because it's not my intention at all, but any missionary will tell you this is certainly not true in many other parts of Africa, but it is true here. They do not stand with their hand out. They are not beggars. And I emphasize that to you. These are a people who do their very utmost to support their work. And they do so by hard work, hard labor. And they give even till it hurts. But there's no way without the help of God's people in the West. There's no way that they can compete with the Roman Catholic Church and put up a school. We noticed every place there was a school, the Roman Catholic Church had built a mission right beside it. And they're sucking in the young people. Now, it's easy to blame Rome. But isn't it better that we would do the same thing instead of simply blaming them for doing it? They're teaching a false religion. But what they're doing, if you believe their religion, makes sense. You go, you set up a mission, you work in the schools, you deal with the young people. Nathaniel's churches have a great number of young people, young Christians. And that's the place to start. With these young people, to get them into their schools, Christian schools, where they'll be taught to the highest level academically, but where they will be taught the things of God, where a true theology will be inculcated, where there will be an integration of the spiritual and the secular, as there ought to be in any decent Christian school, where the Bible is honestly expounded, and where they can grow in grace as well as in education. That's the challenge. I asked Margaret, how much would it cost to do all this? Well, to do it all, there's no way that we could even think of the cost. But just to get started with 8 classrooms and dormitories for those children, we're talking probably $30,000 or $40,000. Now, in United States terms, that's nothing for that kind of accommodation. But in their terms, it may as well be $40 million. And that's the challenge. It's good to pray for these people. They need to be prayed for.
But we must do something more. We must do something more. There are things that we can do that will be little to us, but will be like manna from heaven to them. And one of the most important will be getting their schools off the ground. They already have trained teachers. One thing that shocks you when you go to a country like this, now this is a poor country compared to America. But when you see their children, in many ways they're educated far better than children here. Every little kid is learning to speak at least two or three languages. Somebody like Nathaniel Kendigore speaks, what, maybe six, seven, eight languages. And here we are struggling with one. We can help them in the education. But if you were to go to Nathaniel tonight and say, what is the greatest need? It's not education. It's an outpouring of the Spirit of God. And he has a burden, a vision. And I trust the Free Church will get it. He said, I trust that the Free Presbyterian Church will see Kenya as its launching pad for Africa. We need to concentrate. We need your missionaries, not just your money. In fact, as I say, he never asks for money. I asked Margaret about the financial details. Nathaniel Kendigore never, never, never once mentioned money. But he says, we need your missionaries. You know, you could travel far in Africa before you'd find many African pastors saying, we need your missionaries. We need them. We must work together. This is not just a work for black people or for white people. We must work together here. We must concentrate our efforts. This vision is to reach Western Kenya, then the whole of Kenya. And if you look where Kenya is on a map, he says, see where we can go from here. The continent is open once you have a base. And I believe that that's the message, more than any, that he wanted me to take back to the Free Presbyterian Church in Ulster and in North America. I trust tonight, as I have given you a very brief and sketchy report of what we were trying to do, that you'll understand, if you get this, I'll have succeeded, that here is a mission that's well worth being involved in. Here are people that are among the best of God's people. And here is a work under the leadership of a man who has proved himself true in the hottest fire. What can we do? What can we do? Well, we should pray. Some of you young people need to consider going. Not on a holiday, but on a lifelong work. There is a need in the education field. There is a need, there will be ultimately in the medical field. That's not top of the list, but the need is great. To go to a visit, as we did, an old and apparently dying woman in a hospital there. This is one of the better hospitals. It's an experience. There's going to be a need there. There's a need for old-fashioned missionary work. Some of you young people would need to consider, Lord, what would you have me to do? Where would you have me to go? And if God turns your heart to Africa, there certainly is a launching pad to serve God in that great continent. What can we do? We can pray. We can send missionaries. And yes, we can raise money. This is a generous church, and it gives to many works. And we are stretched apparently as far as we can be stretched. And especially in a church where we never have financial appeals, it's a marvelous thing what God has enabled you all to do. But our generosity will have to stretch even further. Can we do it? If God wills it, we can do it. It's as simple as that. It's not just in the big projects like schools, but there are smaller things. I said to Joan as we were seeing some of these people, you know, it opens up new vistas. You may find you have $200 or $300 that you've been able to lay by. You may want to give it into God's work. You know, there are people there, God's people, who are living on the edge every day, every week, of every month, throughout the year, wondering how that little plot of land is going to produce enough to cover all the needs. And what would be a small gift to us, to one here and one there and one there, may mean a year's tuition, may lift the burden, may enable them to live more fully for God. There are things that we can do. We may not be able to do everything, but it's a capital mistake to think because we can't do everything that we shouldn't do anything. We start where we can, and God will do the rest. Paul and Barnabas stuck it out as long as the Lord would have them do so. Nathaniel Kendigore has stuck it out, is sticking it out, and with joy.